Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, our speaker is Michael Ellsberg, speaking on the college industrial complex and the future of higher education. So we will be, Michael will be speaking for about 45 minutes, then we'll have about 15 minutes of questions and answers. I would please ask that you come up to the mic here. Look at Michael, but be aware that we are videotaping this, and we'd like to have your face caught on the camera. So if you can be aware, it's a little bit funny, but please try and do that and look at both the camera and Michael and make that work. So we are recording today's program. As I said, we're both doing video recording and audio recording. This program will be podcast by the Commonwealth Club in a couple of weeks, available on the Commonwealth Club website. And potentially on the NPR radio program, and probably on Michael's website as well. So I want to tell you a little bit about Michael. This was written in the first person. I'm going to try and translate to the third person. Michael Ellsberg is a book author, specifically the author of The Education of Millionaires. It's Not What You Think, and It's Not Too Late, published by Penguin Portfolio. He also writes a blog on Forbes.com on entrepreneurialism, career development, and education. Michael wrote a very well-received op-ed for the New York Times, Will Dropout Save America, which reached number 6 most emailed on the site, as well as a guest post on Tim Ferriss's blog titled 8 Steps to Getting What You Want Without Formal Education. Michael has spoken at the Googleplex for the Author at Google series, at the World Technology Summit and Awards, and at the Thiel Fellows Foundation and at TEDxSF. Michael grew up in an activist household, a son of Pentagon Paper whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and Patricia Ellsberg, subjects of the Oscar-nominated documentary The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Michael appears in one still shot at the end of the documentary, a babe in his father's arms as he speaks to an anti-war rally in the 1970s. Michael oversees his father's website, Twitter, and Facebook page and enjoys a close relationship with his parents. So Daniel and his wife are here tonight, and I'm very glad that you guys could be here. And I want to thank, you. I want to thank you not only for producing a great, very intelligent son, but for doing something that that a whole lot of us really, really appreciate. And we're very happy to have you here. And I'm happy to have Michael here tonight. I heard Michael at a conference speaking about education. He gave me a copy of his book. I read the book. My wife read the book. We talked about the book in bed, and so that's a very good sign. It is a brilliant book, and I'm very happy that Michael could be here tonight to tell you guys about it. I'd like to introduce Michael Ellsberg.
So I'm going to open tonight's talk with a shocking headline that I read recently from one of our nation's most trusted and respected news sources, The Onion. And the headline reads, "New college graduates to be cryogenically frozen until job market improves." So we could laugh about it. I love The Onion. But the headline points to something actually very, very serious that's happening right now that actually isn't a laughing matter for any of us or for any of the young people that we know and love. And that is that there's a full-blown economic and jobs crisis among America's youth, both college graduates, people who are in school looking for summer employment, who haven't finished school, young people across the board are having an unbelievably hard time finding economic opportunity right now. Here are just a few statistics about it. Here's another headline from a slightly less reputable news source, the New York Times, and it says, "Many with new college degree find the job market humbling." And it goes on, it says that right now, of college graduates under the age of 25, 22% of them don't have jobs. Now, let's just put that in a little bit of context. The Great Depression, unemployment overall was 20%. So essentially what we have right now for young people, and these are people with college degrees, is a depression for young people right now. And, of course, we can talk about this later. I'm sure people will bring up the point that people without degrees are doing much worse, and that's true overall on average. I'll address that point later and in the questions. But right now, let's just talk about what is happening with people who have gone through the system. 22% aren't finding jobs in recent years. The article also points out that of graduates, another 22% aren't in jobs that required any kind of formal education. They're at Starbucks, they're waiting tables, that kind of thing. So 44% did not require their higher education for their employment or their unemployment. And if you look, the picture is much better for engineers. That's one thing where the job prospects really are quite good if you go through an engineering program. But for humanities majors, it's much worse. 56% aren't in a job that required any kind of higher education. So there's this huge crisis going on right now. Just to put this in a little more global context, here's another interesting headline. This is from the blog of a gentleman called Mike Consul, and he's a policy analyst with the Roosevelt Institute. And he wrote a piece called Youth Unemployment in the United States in Line with Arab Spring. Youth Unemployment in the United States in Line with Arab Spring. So we've just seen this remarkable year of uprising around the world. And of course, that had to do with many things. It had to do with political oppression, with corruption, but it was largely youth-led. And clearly one factor that was driving that was the incredible unemployment among young people in these countries, in the Middle East countries. The article had a few statistics. Egypt, which had a revolution led largely by young people, 25% unemployment at the time of Arab Spring. Tunisia, another revolution, 30%. Libya, according to another statistic, 40% youth unemployment. So there seems to be this tipping point when youth unemployment gets to around 25%, when people are realizing that something's not working, and people uprise, they go out in the streets. And if we're not careful, we're almost at those numbers. We're almost at those numbers. If we're not careful, we might see that kind of uprising here. Oops, did I just say that? Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Oakland. Occupy San Francisco. Occupy everything. We are seeing our own Arab Spring here. We are seeing this youth revolt, youth uprising here. And again, that has to do with many, many different things. But clearly, one of the things that if you look at what people are talking about, what their signs say, what the websites say, it's a lot of it is about this outrage of having checked off all the tick boxes. I went to college. I got my good SAT scores. I did everything you said, and I can't get a job. And there's this enormous amount of outrage around that situation. And, this is something that is relatively new. So all of our assumptions about education and all of the things that we believe about it, about higher education, were formed in kind of the golden age of higher education, which is the post-war years and the GI Bill and this massive expansion of educational institutions and massive expansion of the industrial base of the economy, growing economy. So we have all these beliefs about it, and we haven't adjusted our beliefs to what happens when the economy changes massively. And so that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So we've got a full-blown youth economic crisis, and what is the solution? So if you ask most people, what is the solution to this problem? The answer comes very readily: more education. If the education they've got isn't working for them, well, let's get some more. Let's double down. If you don't have a BA, go get a BA. If you got a BA, go get a master's. If you got a master's, go get a PhD. Go get an MBA. Why don't you go get an MA in interdisciplinary communication studies? That'll be your ticket to economic opportunity. That's the thing you're missing, is an MA in interdisciplinary communication studies. And then you will be set for life, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm here to argue the opposite of that. Now, if you don't get shocked, if you don't get angry, or if at least you don't think about some common held assumptions, I will personally refund your ticket price at the end of this. That's what I'm here to do, is to make you think about some commonly held assumptions and hopefully get you riled up a little bit. So most people say more higher education is our way out of this youth economic crisis. I'm going to argue the opposite. My argument is that actually it's not the way out. More higher education is not the solution to the youth economic crisis. It's actually in large part the cause. Now, that's a shocking statement. What could I possibly mean by that? How could I say that higher education is in part causing this youth crisis right now, this youth jobs crisis? Well, three reasons. Number one is debt. Number two is the decline of Fortune 500 companies as an engine of job growth. And number three is the opportunity costs of going to college, the things you don't learn when you're in class learning what's on the curriculum. So let me go through these. Number one, debt. So you've all probably heard personal finance people talk about the dangers of credit card debt. And we've seen recently what the dangers are if you bite off more home debt than you can chew. And right now we are about to see a crisis on the same proportions around student debt. Student debt just passed $1 trillion, which means it also passed the amount of credit card debt outstanding. So I don't know how that compares to home debt, but if you compare student debt, it's now far more than all the credit card balances in America, which is saying a lot because we love our credit cards in America. So basically, we're telling young people to put their higher education on credit card, more or less. And that leads to an average of $24,000 of student debt coming out, $24,000. That didn't used to be the case. Again, this is a new landscape we're in, right? I talked to people who went through Berkeley in the 60s, it was, you know, a couple hundred dollars. Even with inflation, that was worth a lot more back then. But even still, that's not the crazy prices of tuition that we're seeing. The average price for private education now is $12,000 a year. So $48,000 for a private education. Most of that for the people who are going through it is going right on the credit card, essentially. Of course, there's outliers. The most expensive college in the nation now is Sarah Lawrence at $58,000. We're about to see within a year or two our first $60,000 school year being sold on the market. That'll probably be Sarah Lawrence, very likely. So think about that. That's roughly $60,000. So we're getting at almost $250,000 we're saying you have to spend to have access to the job markets. Now, again, I'm going to talk about the issue of how dropouts fare, which on average is worse than that. And I'll address that. But right now we're just talking about how graduates fare. So here's a story I read when I was researching this. A young woman named Courtney Muna graduated NYU in 2005 with $100,000 in debt. So the average is $24,000, but now we're starting to see young people at the start of their adult lives with $100,000 in unsecured debt at the start of their adult lives. And so this was one such young woman. She took that out to get a undergraduate liberal arts degree in religion and women's studies. At the time of that I read the article in 2010, she was earning $22 an hour as an assistant to a photographer. Now, last time I checked, you didn't need to have a degree in women's studies and religion or any degree to be an assistant to a photographer. And it's highly dubious that you needed to take on $100,000 in debt to get that job. Now, let me be clear about something. This is a very, very this is a very dangerous situation that this young woman has gotten herself in. And in fact, that most young people who get in debt and then can't find jobs are getting themselves in. You know, in the housing boom, if you took out more debt than you could handle, if you got one of those no doc loans, one of those no money down loans for your second vacation home or whatever people were doing and all that madness, you could declare bankruptcy. It wasn't going to be pleasant, but you could get out of that debt. You could essentially hand the mortgage company the keys to the house and you'd be out. Not saying it would be fun, but there are ways out. Student debt is one of the only types of debt that is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So if that investment does not pay off for you, you're in deep, deep waters there. And that can be garnished. They can garnish your Social Security benefits. There's no one yet because the student debt issue wasn't around in the 50s and 60s. So we don't have people having their Social Security wages or benefits garnished right now for student debt, but we will be. We are going to see a massive, massive wave of defaults on student loans. And actually, we are seeing that. Again, the New York Times reports that year over year, 2010 from 2009, student loan defaults went, the rate went up 25%. So the current rate is 8.8% of young people defaulting on their student loans. Again, that's not a pretty picture when you default on your student loans. It's a extremely serious situation. The all kinds of penalties kick in. You see stories of people who can't even make their interest payments. So interest is going on top of interest, and it's ballooning upwards. If you Google the word student debt suicide, there's actually a number of stories about this. You know, this didn't happen in the 50s and 60s because there was no student debt because the college cost $800. But now student debt suicide. I'm not saying that's the bulk of the trend, but it's the tip of it right now. We're seeing, if you check with the pulse of the occupiers, of the people who are really starting to raise this issue, there's an enormous amount of sadness, fear, frustration, rage that I think is, if we don't address it, is going to see some kind of cataclysmic uprising around it, like has seen in Arab Spring, because it's just not sustainable. You can't have young people getting into that kind of debt who can't find jobs to pay it off and then can't go into bankruptcy. And this is the start of their adult lives. They're in this situation. So I'm going to talk about the next issue here, the next cause, which is the decline of Fortune 500 companies as engines of job creation. I know I'm a bit somber here. I'm going to get into the hopeful stuff at the end, but bear with my somber for one or two more points. So decline of Fortune 500 companies. So again, our current education system, higher education system as it exists now, was designed roughly in the 50s and 60s. That was a time of American predominance around, you know, corporate growth. And we were the unchallenged leaders in growth. These large companies were coming into being, were growing, expanding industrial base. They needed expanding ranks of middle managers to fill all the industrial base and the factories. And the education system did very well to pump out people who could be those managers. And that was the system that we had in place. Of course, we live in a very, very different universe now. Now we live in, you know, American manufacturing has almost disappeared. We're in the age of outsourcing, downsizing, offshoring, automation. There's a book that I just donated recently to a Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign for a book called "Will Robots Steal Your Job?" And so, you know, there's all this automation happening. And we're just in a very, very different economy right now. And so a study from the National Bureau of Economic Research, actually, excuse me, I'll get to that in a moment. A study from education think tank called the Kauffman Foundation compared who was adding jobs in our economy and who was taking them away. And so we think of, you know, these large companies, they must be large. They're large, so they must be the ones adding all the jobs. Actually, that's not the case. The large corporations, they do hire a lot, but they also fire a lot. They downsize a lot. And this study from the Kauffman Foundation found that the large corporations in America were actually net job losers. So they hire a bunch, but they fire more to downsizing. They're net job destroyers. So where does job creation come from? That was actually the title of this study. And the study said, startups aren't everything when it comes to job growth. They're the only thing. Startups aren't everything when it comes to job growth. They're the only thing. So now I'm going to get into a little bit more of the hopeful side of this talk. So we have this moribund, stagnant system where people have gone through the system to get these entry-level jobs at Fortune 500 companies. The companies are downsizing, offshoring. There's no jobs there. So where are the jobs? So the jobs are happening right now in startups. Another study from the National Bureau of Economic Research found that nearly all net job creation in America comes from startup businesses. Now, I want to make a distinction here between, you often hear that small businesses are the engine of job growth, but the study actually makes a distinction between small business and startup businesses. Because most startups are small, they get conflated often, but the ones who are really adding jobs are new businesses. Now, we know here in San Francisco, in the cradle of innovation, Silicon Valley, that a lot of these startups that add jobs, the jobs will be gone in about a year because the startups will be gone. But the study found, as long as there's enough of these startups that are out there adding jobs, you know, as long as some of them stay alive and some of them do, they're net job creators. Because think about it, they go from zero to some amount. So if some number of those organizations stay alive, they're going from zero to that amount. And if you think about it, startups are really the only area of the economy where one metric of success is how many jobs you've added, right? I know a lot of entrepreneurs who are here in this room. And a startup will talk about, oh, we have 5 employees now. Oh, we just went to 10. We just went to 100. We just went to 500. So that's a metric of success, right? Can you imagine someone in a Fortune 500 company saying, well, we just went to 50,000 jobs or something like that? They talk about how to get rid of jobs. That's the conversation they have. So it's all about startups. Again, this is a relatively new phenomenon. This obviously, startups are not a new phenomenon, but this entrepreneurial economy where everyone is doing a startup, and there's a culture of entrepreneurialism and a culture of startups. This is a fairly new phenomenon in a culture of venture financing, and it is recent compared to our education system. And our education system hasn't really caught up that's where the jobs are happening. So the last point I want to talk about on this question of how our education system is funneling into the youth unemployment crisis is the issue of opportunity costs. So there's, on this topic of startups creating jobs, there's a great blog I just found called Working for Wonka, Surviving a Startup. And it's the first blog, so far as I know, about how to get a job in a startup, not how to be an entrepreneur, which I think is a great thing. And I think more young people should be entrepreneurs, but not everyone's going to be an entrepreneur. So there's some people who just want a job, but the jobs now are at the startups. So this is the first educational piece I know of, that blog I found, about how to get a job in a startup. And this woman who writes it, her name is Kathy Ver-Eck, and she has a piece entitled Why You Must Drop Out Now to Get a Job Later. And she says, if you're looking for a job, you better start looking at startups. And the best way to get a job at a startup is not by going to the best school. The best way to get a job at a startup is by bringing the best street cred, specifically startup street cred. So that's what I want to talk to you about, is opportunity costs, is that our education system was designed to help young people get entry-level jobs at large organizations, either governmental organizations or large Fortune 500 companies. And there's a set of skills that you learn that are very useful to that. And it's done very well in helping young people get those jobs in the past. But there's a whole different set of skills that is involved in being in a small, dynamic company that just isn't taught in school. You learn it by doing. It's not an academic discipline. It's something that you just have to be in the trenches, and you have to accumulate some wounds and have some blood spilled to know what it's like to go through that kind of early day startup experience. And this article is arguing that that's the kind of experience that young people should be getting. They should be in the trenches with where the dynamism is happening in our economy, and accumulate the kind of street cred, the kind of entrepreneurial resume, if you will, which looks very different than, say, a management consulting resume. And that's what's going to allow them to get into this sector of the economy where there's a lot of dynamism happening. Not to mention that I hope more of these young people just create their own job, right? I mean, many of them don't want to be entrepreneurs, but we need some percentage of people to be starting these companies, or else the jobs aren't going to be there. So not only working for a startup, but learning how to create businesses. So there's this huge opportunity cost where if you're, I'm talking about people who are motivated and ambitious. If you have a situation where a young person just doesn't have any drive, doesn't have any ambition, it's very hard to make an entrepreneur out of that kind of person. There has to be the pre-existing passion, the pre-existing will, drive to learn. So let's just take the population of young people who are motivated, who are ambitious, who want to do things about their lives, with their lives already. And you take some portion of that population, or most of it, and put them through our current academic programs, and they're learning one set of things. But that means they're not learning a bunch of other things during that time. They could learn it later, but during those 4 years leading up to when they're going to be 22 and looking for jobs, they're not doing anything remotely relevant to what would make an entrepreneur want to hire them. So I spent 2 years interviewing people who just decided to opt out of that whole system. They saw the problems. They weren't interested in that kind of learning, and maybe they weren't good at it, and they just decided to educate themselves. So I interviewed people who either dropped out of college or just didn't go and then went on to become entrepreneurs. Some of them are very famous. Some of them became insanely wealthy. I interviewed a few billionaires, Sean Parker, founding president of Facebook, who, by the way, is very different in person than Justin Timberlake plays him in that movie. Matt Mullenweg, who founded WordPress, which I run my own blog on, and probably a lot of you, if you have blogs, are familiar with WordPress. So those are the famous people and the very wealthy people. And you could say, oh, well, they're outliers, right? They're the ones who got lucky. And there is some aspect to that. That kind of wild entrepreneurial success, especially when you're talking about someone who becomes a billionaire, that, yes, they worked hard. Yes, they're brilliant. Yes, they had great ideas. But there was an enormous amount of luck and serendipity that goes into having that level of success. But if we as a society decide that anyone who decides to start a business, if they're successful, they're an outlier, we got a big problem on our hands, because those are the people who are going to be creating our jobs. So if they're outliers, we don't got any jobs. So that is the danger we're in a system that wasn't really designed, doesn't understand entrepreneurialism, doesn't understand the kind of skills, the kind of resume credibility you need to have to function in that ecosystem, which is very different than the kind of credibility you're going to need if you want to get, say, a job at an investment bank, for example. So I spent a couple years interviewing these people. I wrote a book called The Education of Millionaires, and I talk about the kind of things that you can learn on your own. Now, you can learn these things after college. And in fact, I wrote my book with the intention that it would be a guide for young people who just graduated. This is the book that I wish I had. And I did graduate. I went to Brown and graduated in 99. This is the book I wish I had when I graduated. I didn't, so I wrote it. These are the kind of skills you can learn them later, but that's if you want to play that game of being 22 and having just spent 16 odd years of your life going through this formal education system and now not knowing what you want to do, having a hard time finding a job that makes use of your credential, you know, 50-50 shot of that, and a 25% shot of not even having a job. And I wanted to give the skills that you could learn if you just decide you want to not have that system, not go through that system. So I talk about street cred, street smart skills, not book smart skills, that actually make it very likely that you'll be able to find economic opportunity for yourself. I talk about the importance of learning how to build a network. That's key. Most of these, if you want a job in this dynamic sector of the economy, in general, it doesn't happen through submitting a cold resume to a stranger. In general, it happens through who you know. And networking it has a bad rap. People hate the word networking. It seems kind of schmoozy or sleazy. But I try to rebrand that term because it's an essential skill. And if we don't encourage young people to start building their networks young and networks of business owners, of potential business opportunity, they're going to be stuck sending resumes through Craigslist. And I don't know if anyone here has ever sent out a resume through Craigslist, but it's not a very fun experience. You don't hear anything back. You just sit there and you hear crickets for months. possibly. Business owners I know, when they do post these ads, they often get 2,000 resumes for positions. I've heard of high level ones getting 2,000 resumes. It's very common to have 200. That's a normal number. Is if you post a job, you're going to get 200 resumes. So there, everyone's competing on how can I make my resume look good. Well, you're trying to look good in a pile of 200. You know that this is 200 pages about. So you're trying to look good at somewhere in the middle of a stack of sheets right there. And you're going to look a lot better if you actually know the person. So I talk about networking. I talk about sales, another skill. If you learn how to sell, most of the people that I interviewed for my book had some kind of sales training very young. Often it was door-to-door sales, which I don't think in general that's a very uplifting or positive thing in society. But these people cut their chops. They learn sales skills, whether it was that or just getting in a position where they're learning to sell. That, again, is a really easy way to create economic opportunity for yourself. It's a non-academic discipline. You don't learn it. Even MBA programs, typically, you don't learn sales. So there's all these real-world kind of chops out there available. And my argument is that in this economy where we are facing some very, very challenging situations for young people, we're doing them a disservice by telling them not to learn those things until 22. And I just think that's too late. I think I've talked to too many young people who are just doing amazing things right now. That you can go with the internet, you can start social movements. Young people are starting all kinds of movements, businesses, campaigns, things where they're out in the trenches doing real things, selling things, making things, creating things, persuading, changing minds, and learning leadership, out there learning leadership. You know, a lot of the benefit of college comes in the extracurricular activities. I think most people, including myself, who went through college will agree with that. Well, you don't need college for extracurricular activities. They're available. They're available to anyone for these motivated, ambitious young people that we're talking about. And you don't necessarily need to go into debt for that to have that. So we're going to take some time for questions very soon. I want to just address, I can predict with 99.8% accuracy several of the questions you're going to ask. So I want to address them now, and then we can get on to new questions. So the first thing, the first objection, the first question that I'm going to hear is college is not just about money or jobs. It's about many more things. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I'll rephrase that. Education is about many more things than what kind of job you're going to get or how much you're going to earn. Of course it is. I'm a passionate reader. You should see my bookshelf. Even in the age of Kindle, my bookshelf is stuffed full of all kinds of books that have made a massive, massive mark on my life. I'm passionate about young people getting excited about reading. I'm an author. If they weren't young people excited about reading, I wouldn't have a market coming up to sell my books. But the question we have to ask is, do young people have to go into $24,000 or $100,000 of debt to get all these other wonderful forms of learning out there, right? You know, last time I checked, books are pretty cheap. You can go to the library, you can get them on your Kindle or Nook for $10. There's this explosion of information out there. There's a company called The Learning Company, which I like a lot. And what they do is they scour the nation for the best professors they can find, the best teaching professors on every topic, from the humanities to the sciences to history to everything. And then they, of that group, they find the very, very best. So they go through multiple levels of selection to find not the professors that had you asleep in your seat during class, but the ones that had you on the edge of your seat. And then they record those people and they make the entire course available for a couple $100. And we're not talking about a few 20-minute video clips here. We're talking 36 hours of an entire semester's worth of lectures. And I've heard these lectures, and they're phenomenal, and they make me want to learn more about every topic they have. So that's that passion for learning that, to me, schools saying, oh, well, young people need to learn how to be passionate readers, and we do that. To me, that's like That's like a drug dealer, you know, decrying that there's not after school programs to keep kids off the street. You know, the schools are the worst offenders in killing curiosity for reading out of people. And this is starting very young. So 56% of Americans do not develop a habit of reading for pleasure after school. 56, the majority do not. If you want to get kids excited about something, excited about reading, excited about learning, you don't make them do compare and contrast essays on it. That's the worst way to get people excited about it. You don't make them memorize and do those, you know, since the dawn of man, blah, 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 and then I'll show that this novel is related to that trend. And that's how you kill this passion for learning. There's a book I recommend called Read Aside, which is about how schools systematically train this passion and curiosity out of young people. I'm not saying every school, I'm not saying for everyone, but if you look at the trend, that's where the trend is. Next question, I'm certain that I'm going to hear at some point. Well, you need a college degree as a credential to get a job. You need a college degree as a credential to get a job. And I would say that is true in many cases, but it depends a lot on what you want to do. So I've already mentioned engineering, being a doctor. Those are the two areas, by the way, where I would unequivocally say, if you want to do those things, that higher education makes a lot of sense. There's a shortage of engineers. There's a shortage of doctors. You need those credentials to get those jobs. There's booming economy for that kind of work. So I'm not debating that. But what if you just don't know what you want to do? You know, what if you aren't sure? What if you want to work in the nonprofit sector? You know, what if you want to start a business? Then it becomes much more questionable whether you need to go through this very expensive and long system. And remember, we're not just talking about 4 years. We're talking about, you know, 12 years of grooming up to that. Now, obviously, there's some amount that's just this basic education that everyone needs, the 3 R's. But once you get to, you know, sophomore or junior in high school, it's pretty much all about getting into college. That's what you're being groomed for. So it's not just those 4 years. It's possibly 8 years to get you through to get this credential. So I'm reminded of another Onion headline. They were talking about the jobs crisis and the recession and their solution. Well, we have this recession. So our solution, our way out of it, why don't we just give everyone another degree? And so that kind of points to this credentialism that we've gotten into where everyone is chasing to get the next degree, to get a higher degree. Once again, I'll follow up an Onion headline with a real headline from the New York Times. There's an article, The Masters as the New Bachelors. The masters as the new bachelors. And it's talking about how there's this new phrase that's very common in job hunts called BA required, masters preferred. So a lot of people are seeing that and they think, well, wow, BA required. I definitely need a BA and I should probably get a master's. And the article ends, given how many people are now getting masters to stand out from bachelors, will the PhD become the new masters? So think about that. It takes, to get a PhD, you're in your late 20s or your early 30s. And life expectancy is, you know, 79. So we're saying to young people, they should be spending, you know, somewhere between a quarter and a third of their life getting these credentials. That's a crazy system. This is what is called an arms race. It's an educational credentials arms race. And like all arms races, the only people who benefit are the arms dealers. And we have to make a distinction between getting a credential and learning. Learning is always good. I am passionate about learning. I'm a lifelong learner. I spend all my time, a good deal of my money, learning. If you want to get ahead, you got to learn. Do you need to keep getting these more fancier, more expensive credentials? Again, certain segments, yes. If you want to go into a very elite investment bank, then your credentials are everything. If you want to go into a law degree and go into specifically a elite corporate law career, credentials are very important. But there's all these other areas, specifically this entrepreneurial economy I'm talking about, where they really don't care where you went to school. What matters, or if you went to school, what matters is can you add value to this business? Can you do what needs to be done? And there's so many ways to demonstrate that now. People are creating portfolios of their work. blogs, showing, demonstrating their expertise, of course, networking, where you have someone vouch for your skills, is another way, again, to demonstrate your value without these credentials. 80% of jobs are found through networks. There's been a lot of study of this. Only 20% of positions that get filled are filled with cold resume submissions. So our education system optimizes for that 20% of the jobs, where, of the positions, where you need to have, you need to stand out from the other resumes. But the other 80% of jobs that get filled generally get filled through someone who knows someone, someone who makes a referral for you. In that situation, your resume, your formal resume, the bullet points on your resume make a lot less of a difference than someone being able to say, you know what, this person has a lot of experience and they, you know, they're going to do the job, and having that kind of referral, having a portfolio of your work. So again, this situation is shifting a lot. Final question that I know I can anticipate, and then we'll actually get to your questions, which I'm very excited to hear, is this issue that college graduates earn more. College graduates earn more. And there's something, there's a lot of talk about what's called the college degree earnings premium. And if you look statistically, this is absolutely true. There is a correlation between more formal education and higher earnings. It just, it goes up pretty much like a straight line. So if you don't have, if you graduated high school but don't have a college degree, median earnings are $33,800. This is as of a year or two ago. If you do complete your degree, median earnings go up to $55,700, which is an increase in 60%. Then it goes straight up from there from master's and PhD. There's a pretty serious problem with that. Yes, you can show a correlation, but all these people who are talking about that probably went through a statistics class. And the first thing you learn in a statistics class is that you can't derive any causality out of showing correlations. So if you break down those numbers, 40% of those earnings differentials can be accounted for by IQ scores. So right there, I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Smarter people tend to earn more. Smarter people also tend to go to college. That doesn't mean that college made those people smarter necessarily. And if you see what's happening on college campuses, it's very hard to believe that those colleges are making people smarter, right? There's a, you may have heard of this study that came out last year called Academically Adrift. It found that, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it found that something, students were studying like 12 hours a week, something like devoting somewhere around 12 hours a week or maybe 15 to going to class and doing homework. What's the rest? Climbing gyms, spas, you know, they're built. That's part of why they're so expensive now. You're getting these $60,000 tuitions, is they're turning into country clubs for 18 to 22 year olds. There's a book called The 5-Year Party, and it's about this phenomenon. The reason it's called the 5-year party is that that's the average amount of time now it takes to get through college, not 4 years, it's five. Part of it because they're partying so much. You know, binge drinking, all this stuff is going on. So back to this point about correlation causality, you can also explain a lot of the higher earnings premium. Another factor is if you're married, that accounts for about 30% of that earnings differential. So these are what are called in statistics conflating factors. Typically, more ambitious people are the ones who tend to go to college, and more ambitious people typically earn more. So saying that college added value in that situation, I can't argue the opposite and say it didn't add value. I'm just saying we don't have the correlation. Doesn't really mean anything. It could be a lot of different factors that are causing higher earnings. So something you'll hear in this discussion very often is the $1 million earnings premium of going to college. So even though correlation clearly does not equal cause, the marketers and salespeople of higher education explicitly argue that it does, even though there's no statistical basis for that whatsoever. Sandy Baum, who's a spokesperson for the College Board, which is the organization that administers SATs, said that the evidence for the individual economic benefit of college is enormous. And then she cited those correlations again. So she's explicitly saying that correlate, that the correlation equals a causation. Because of that, these people argue that if you go to college, you'll have $1 million earnings premium. If you add up that 60% more per year, then add it up over a typical 40-year work span, you get roughly $1 million. I wasn't a math person. Partly I went to Brown, partly because I didn't have to take math there. I didn't take any math, but I did a little bit of math around this. And I looked at the average amount that a person pays for private college education is $12,000 per year. That's what they actually pay. There's the sticker price. What they say on the brochures is usually more, but most people get some form of financial aid. So the net price, as they call it, the average is $12,000. So 4 years, that's $48,000. So I did a little math. If you talk to financial planners and they talk about retirement planning, they'll often use a expected return of the stock market at around 8%. Now, that's obviously hasn't panned out in the last 10 years or so, but if you look historically over decades and decades and decades, the expected return of a broad index is 8%, and that's often, you'll hear that cited in retirement planning. So I just looked, if you put $12,000 in this year, invested it in an index fund, $12,000 the next year, $12,000 the year after that, 4 years, just keep it, let it sit in the index fund. By the time you're 65, you'll have $1,258,000, 122. So you can sit on the beach and watch YouTube cat videos for 40 years, and you'll not only get your earnings, $1 million earnings premium, but you can also buy a Lamborghini on top of that. So this whole college is being, this is the stuff that they use to get people to pay these $60,000 years. And it's being marketed in a fraudulent way. That is fraudulent marketing. And it's getting the people who can at least afford it to be paying these enormously inflated sums. Why are they charging so much? Because they know they can. There's huge demand for it. Harvard could fill its entire incoming freshman class four times over with students that it deems qualified for Harvard. And most of the elite colleges are like that. You know, they're turning away, they typically turn away, you know, 90%, 80%, 70% of the people who want to go there. So there's huge demand for this education, partly because of that kind of PR and marketing. And that's what I'm trying to counteract a little bit here. And I hope we can get some discussion going to talk about alternatives. So the last thing I want to say, and then I'd love to open it up for discussion, is that I think this is a problem that needs to be solved. Higher education is far too expensive. Young people shouldn't be taking on that amount of debt for it unless they're going in one of these narrow fields like engineering or being a doctor. It used to be being a lawyer was a sure bet, but now, you know, the law profession has become a lot less of a sure thing than it used to be, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. And if you Google the term law school scam or law scam, there's a whole movement of recent law graduates who are up in arms that they've accumulated another $250,000 in debt on top of their undergraduate debt. And I cite one story of a guy who did that, $250,000 in debt to go to a second or third tier law school, and he's doing $10 an hour legal temp work right now. So there's, you know, the law students are up in arms, but engineering and medicine are still pretty good bets if you can do it. But for the rest of everyone, there's a huge problem happening, and where there's a problem, that's where entrepreneurs come in. And we're seeing right now just the beginning wisps, not even wisps, I should say that the first wave really of educational entrepreneurialism. And my prediction, you can mark my words, is that in 5 years, we're going to see an education company that is as pervasive, as disruptive as Facebook and Google were when they came around, and as impactful in the education sphere as they are in their spheres. Someone's going to get this right. Someone's going to figure out this system. I don't think it's going to be the existing institutions. They just have too much to gain from the way it is. They love the steady stream of people willing to pay them $60,000 a pop per year. So they have no incentive to change it. But there are massive waves of discontent that are just starting to hit now. So a lot of the assumptions, as I said, about education were formed in the 50s and 60s when it was a totally different picture and a much rosier picture for education and for the economy. So to say that, you know, not opting out of college is a disaster when basing it on what happens to people who opted out back then, that was correct. But that's like someone from a typewriter industry saying, you know, if you compare people who have typewriters and people who don't have typewriters write by hand, the ones with the typewriters do a lot better and they write more efficiently and they get more words out. Well, that was true for most of the history of typewriters. And then somewhere around mid 70s, early 80s, something called the personal computer came around. And I could imagine there was a time when having a personal computer was an outlier in itself, right? So you could still look at the averages, and most people who didn't have typewriters were not doing as well because most of them were writing by hand. But then there was this innovation called the computer, and pretty soon it was no longer an innovation. It was diffused throughout the society, and those people who derived those benefits from going outside the reign of the typewriter system were then the norm. Well, the exact same analogy is happening now, where yes, if you look historically, people without degrees have fared worse on average. But times are changing, and there is a sector of young people. I'm not saying it's the mainstream, but there's a sector of young, dynamic people who are imagining alternatives, who are imagining a system outside of this insane system that I've created. They're learning. I'm not saying to stop learning. They're learning. They're just doing it on their own terms, informally, decentralized, through the internet, inexpensively, without taking on all this crazy debt. And ladies and gentlemen, I really hope that you join me in making that future a reality. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the College Industrial Complex with Michael Ellsberg, author of The Education of Millionaires. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. So we have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions now. I would ask that you please do come up to the mic. Remember that we are video recording this as well. So, Michael, I have one question for you I'd like to start with. I read your book. I laughed more than I did tonight. What's the fun part of your book? What's the part to make us laugh and make us feel optimistic when we leave tonight? If we buy your book, maybe.
The fun part is that there's so many people out there. In fact, a few of them are in the audience here right now that I know personally who are creating alternatives to this, and they're vibrant. They're passionate about learning. They're excited to create new systems to this pressing problem. And you know, they're rascals, right? They're rebels right now. I don't think they're going to be rebels in 10 or 20 years, but right now it's a rebellion. And there's this society we constructed around the concept of the organization man. That book came out in the 50s that described pretty well the economy that we had in the 50s, these mass corporations, bureaucracies, organizations that basically wanted mass numbers of undifferentiated labor talent to become these organization men. And it was mostly men back then. And these people are rebelling against it right now. So there's just a wonderful cast of characters who are leading the revolution on this. I write about them a lot in my book, and they're out there. They're making this happen.
Yes. My name is Ben Konek, and I'm a social entrepreneur working on education. And my company name is M2Teach, Mobility to Teach. It's engaged to empower and inspire teachers, parents, and students for lifelong learning. That my thing is that the technology is going so fast and so quick that you're going to have to learn your whole life. You're going to maybe have to take a course. And there's a conference going on right now called the DML, Digital Media Learning, through a couple other universities, of people who really care about kids and students and decent getting teachers paid 2x, 3x more for a badging system just like Cub Scouts, where you'll have a lifelong experience of learning.
Absolutely. I am so excited about the concept of lifelong learning. I'm a lifelong learner. I wrote this book really because I realized that most of the things that I value in my life the business, my writing career that I have now, learning how to create, bring resources into my life, doing what I love, also personal things, learning how to be in relationship. That was definitely a learning curve. It did not come naturally to me, but I've learned a thing or two and am happily married now. Learning about health. You know, my health wasn't that great in my 20s, partly from all the partying that I was doing in college. And so that was all lifelong learning. It happened after college. It happened informally, outside of formal institutions. Didn't typically spend a lot of money to learn it, but it was a lot of sweat learning. I put a lot of sweat and blood and tears into learning that. And you know, we have this system, again, that is designed to pump out people credentialed for essentially middle management jobs in Fortune 500 companies. And so there's a certain amount of credentialing that has to happen to get those people into those jobs. So we've created this system where we front load learning for the first 22 years until you're 22, and then you go into the job. But what if we had a system where young people weren't expected to get involved in this crazy educational credentialing arms race where they're expected to possibly have a master's or even a PhD and not enter the workforce till they're 30? What if they apprenticed? I think that's a really important word. Apprentice has a better ring than intern, right? What if they apprenticed at a startup starting at 15 or 16? 15 and 16-year-olds, if they're somewhat ambitious, somewhat bright, are certainly old enough to be apprentices in small businesses. So apprentice there and do book learning. I'm a writer. I will never diss book learning. I love book learning. I write books. But I want to see this balance between learning the career skills starting young. Most of the people I write about started learning these things when they were 16. So they had 6 years on top of their peers. When their peers were 22 before they started figuring this stuff out, they were 16 figuring out the ways of the world, figuring out developing networks of employers and business owners that they know, and learning at the same time, a conversation between practice and learning. So yes, absolutely, I'm in favor of that.
Hi, I'm Pierre. So I basically agree with what you say, but I'm from France, so we don't have exactly the same problem, but we might go there. So there is a lot of initiative, like for instance, UN College, Teal Fellowship, which are a good alternative to the education problem. But that leads more to give a more greater awareness of the problem. But once there will be this awareness, what will be like the large scale alternative to the problem? What's your take on that?
Thank you. Yes. So first of all, a lot of this problem is an American focused problem. We're the only educational system in the world that I know of that saddles young people with with $25,000 in debt when they graduate. It's different in other schools where you don't have to go into such crazy debt to get your education. But still, even without the debt, there's the time aspect. Not only the time in school, which is valuable time. Between 18 and 22 is time that you could get what you need to know to hit the ground running. So your 20s are set for career-wise. So there's time being spent, which I think is largely to get these credentials in this credential arm race, which is wasted. So there's a lot of thought right now about what the alternatives are. And I think that it's going to focus a lot around the concept, as I said before, of apprenticing. I think we need to bring back the apprentice model where people become apprentices, then they move on and they become what used to be called a journeyman, then they become a master. And we can have partnerships between business and our school system, and even government can get involved in this. And we can have partnerships to create apprenticeship programs and have that. Not that they're going into the dark satanic mills never learn another thing when they're 13, right? But to be in the conversation of business starting young while they're also augmenting their book learning. I think not only is that the solution, but the solution is already starting to pop up. You did mention the Teal Fellowship, which is one small example. And you know, there's many, many different programs right now. There's a whole phenomenon now called the incubator phenomenon. If you Google startup incubators, there's hundreds, maybe even thousands of these organizations that nurture entrepreneurial talent in young people. It's a new trend. I think that our education system is going to be moving largely towards that hands-on system. And there's, for any entrepreneurs in the room, there's a lot of opportunity to make a difference here. There is, I don't want to be all down. I don't want to be all, sour grapes here. There's a dynamic disruption, a dynamic innovation that's happening that we can all get involved with.
Hi, Michael. My name is Shang. I'm 23 and a relatively recent graduate of UC Berkeley. And I totally agree with most of the things that you do say. And myself, I've gone through a Fortune 500 company as well as two startups in just the last 2 years. But my question, but at the same time, I realize that we're very fortunate to be in the Silicon Valley in San Francisco, where it is the hotbed of innovation. However, what about the rest of America, kind of like middle America, or even within California? Bakersfield probably has less opportunities to network as well as other opportunities than San Francisco. So I guess what is your advice for young people in those areas that might not have such great opportunities as the Silicon Valley?
Great question. So, I live in New York. I travel here a lot to the Bay Area. You can get in this bubble of kind of New York, Bay Area, where everyone is an entrepreneur, it seems. And I would just go back to, for the rest of America, I would just go back to those studies I cited, which showed that job creation comes from startups. So yes, we have this wonderful startup economy here and in New York. And in some ways, it's overheated, right? There's almost another tech bubble happening right now in the Bay Area. But there's a lot of places where there's not an entrepreneurial bubble at all. And, we need startups in Detroit. The GM is not going to create jobs in Detroit. We can just accept that one as settled, right? So who is going to create them? Startups, small businesses, maybe not fancy, social media apps, but a startup doesn't have to be a social media app. It can be a startup of a local business. And now also with the internet, anyone who can afford an internet connection has access to a global market. And there's all kinds of stories now of, 15-year-olds. I interviewed a lot of them for my book, 15-year-olds starting profitable businesses from their bedroom. And there's a great phrase from Daniel Pink, who's an author who's written a lot about this. He calls it digital Marxism. And the idea is that when this country was being founded, most people were, and it was mostly men back then, most people were small businessmen, right? The butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, right? And so you had these small businesses and entrepreneurs, more or less, who were creating the economy. And then what happened is the means of production, to use Marx's term, became so expensive that the candlestick maker and the butcher and the baker couldn't own them anymore. And you had these large factories that had to be owned by corporations, and the workers became interchangeable units who could just be plugged in. They were the labor that fueled the factories. And what's happening now is that for certain sectors, the means of production, to use that phrase again, have once again become within the hands of one person. So you're seeing this huge boom in micropreneurialism, self-employment, flexible work from home, all these options that people can use, not just in San Francisco, not just in New York, but everywhere to create opportunity for themselves.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one more question. I'm sorry, but Michael will be around to answer questions afterwards and to sign books, which we do have for sale out in the lobby. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Daniel Ellsberg and the College Industrial Complex. It's Daniel Ellsberg's son. I'm sorry.
I've heard that one before.
Daniel Ellsberg's most famous son, Michael Ellsberg. I'm very sorry. I was looking right at his father when I said that. Our program tonight is Michael Ellsberg, and we do have time for one last question.
Ariana. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Michael. I really enjoyed your talk and your book. My question is, you didn't so much address this, but it's sort of touched upon. Not only is higher education struggling, but also beginning in kindergarten, we're having failing school problems. So if part of your premise is that we need to really teach people to be lifelong learners and create networks that aren't just through these hallowed halls and institutions, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about if you have envisioned how that looks, maybe for people more in middle America, not from privileged backgrounds, who have networks that are outside of the schools anyway, or who have educated parents. How to sort of start that disruptive technology revolution and get it there?
Great question. So this is about, I've been mostly talking about kind of the ambitious, the elite of people and what they should be doing. So this is about the everyone, the 99%, as the occupiers are saying. And again, this system trains young people. We have a system where everyone is going towards the ideal of getting into Harvard, right? Even the people, not everyone's going to get into Harvard, obviously, but even the people who aren't going to get into Harvard are being trained into this ideal of academic perfection. And so they're, everyone is being put through the same curriculum to the same end. And think of how much diversity there is out there. Think of how many different ways there are to contribute. Think of how many different ways there are to make a mark, to serve others. One way is to be a professor, to study things, to disseminate knowledge, to advance learning, and that does make a mark. But we act as if that's the only way. We essentially train all young people in America to become professors. It's an insane system. Only the people who are going to become professors, and I think that that shouldn't be based just on you know, IQ or SATs or whatever. There should be kind of farm teams going out, finding the people who really have talent. They should be training for that. But think of all the other ways there are to make a difference that people could be learning about and should be learning about from a young age, from starting organizations, getting involved in communities, starting businesses, learning all kinds of different skills that are related to providing value. I think in closing, I'll say that the fundamental thing that people should be learning if they want to create economic opportunity for themselves is they should do a deep dive into the study of value, how to create value. And I can say from experience, having gone through the system, that in that system, you don't create very much value, right? Has anyone read a book of, you know, student papers written by undergraduates? There's not a lot of work at the up to the undergraduate and through the undergraduate level that's really creating a lot of value for anyone out there. Whereas you can learn, the tools are in people's hands to learn how to start businesses that do create value in the community, to get involved in movements that create value, to be creating art. I mean, we're cutting art funding, we're cutting all kinds of music funding. There's so many different ways to be creating value, and we're cutting 80 or 90% off of them to straitjacket people into this narrow, test-based academic system. And I really hope you'll all join me in changing that system. Thank you so much.
Okay, I would like to thank our speaker, Michael Ellsberg, tonight for a wonderful presentation on the College Industrial Complex. With that, I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home. And I will close our program tonight here at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion.